Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. This is episode 9. To most people, the word viper is for a type of snake. To NASA project scientists, viper, V-I-P-E-R, is an acronym for the Volatiles Investigating Polar Exploration Rover. This vehicle is scheduled to be sent to the South Pole of the Moon in 2023 November, where it will explore at least one permanently shadowed region, or PSR. Here is how the project was announced several years ago.
The future of human space exploration is being driven by what we can discover and accomplish on the Moon. And with NASA's confirmation of ice existing at the lunar South Pole, the critical task of finding and mapping where water exists, what form it is in, and where it came from can now begin. Leading us on that journey will be NASA's first mobile robotic mission on the Moon, known as Viper, the Volatiles Investigating Polar Exploration Rover. It will be delivered to the Nobile region of the South Pole as part of NASA's Commercial Lunar Payload Services Initiative. This region sits just outside the western rim of Nobile Crater and covers an area of 36 square miles. As the first ever resource mapping mission on the surface of another celestial body, Viper will roam the surface equipped with three science instruments and a drill to detect and analyze various lunar soil environments at a range of depths and temperatures. The rover will venture into permanently shadowed craters, some of the coldest spots in the solar system, where ice reserves have been preserved for billions of years. NASA had four critical parameters when choosing a landing site for Viper: available sunlight, Earth visibility for communications from the Moon to the Earth, data showing the potential presence of water and other resources, and terrain that is well suited for Viper to navigate. The area to the west of Nobile Crater met these conditions. Once on the surface, Viper's mission will last 100 days and cover between 10 to 15 miles. And while a baseline traverse route through the Nobile region has been identified for the rover, the scientific discoveries Viper makes along the way will actually influence where the mission team sends it next, so its planned route will most likely change. During its travels, Viper will visit at least six locations where data suggests ice could be found. By helping determine the locations of where water and other resources exist, Viper's findings will help pave the way for future landing sites under NASA's Artemis program. The prospects of achieving a long-term human presence on our Moon never look so bright.
Antony Colaprete is a NASA planetary scientist and has scored the plum job of Viper's project scientist. In August of 2021, he gave this description of this contribution to NASA's Commercial Lunar Payload Services, or CLIPS program.
I'm the project scientist for VIPER. I'll give you a general overview of it and what it plans to do and the status of the project. So as we've heard over the last couple decades, there's just been a revolution in our appreciation of water on the moon and other volatiles in general. We think there's everything from frost to potential blocks of ice to deep water, shallow, like Kevin was describing. I think there's a general appreciation, too, that more observations are needed, in particular observations at the surface. And so this is where VIPER comes in. VIPER is the first, meant to be the first, not the final, the first step in that exploration, looking at water, trying to understand the origin of lunar water, but also understand the how water could be a resource moving forward to that. And we've really modeled the measurement plan and the techniques and processes after terrestrial resource exploration processes. USGS has been, and other mining companies have been doing this for many, many years and have developed an incredible set of processes, tools, et cetera, that we are borrowing, adapting, really for the first time to off-world exploration. Right now, we are a confirmed mission with our critical design review this October, gotten here really fast, and we are set still, holding schedule for launch in November 2023. So VIPER is all about understanding lunar water. Everything we've learned over the last decade, including the observations from M-cubed, surficial water, the L-cross results showing potentially a stratified layer of everything from 1% up to maybe 5 or even 10% water at depth. And we understand that there's this distribution both laterally and vertically now that is paramount to both exploration and science in terms of answering and addressing key questions about its origin and its general nature. Asking more questions than we have answers. So there isn't a good solid understanding. There's a lot of contradictory observations. As Kevin pointed out, Mercury seems to behave itself. Where it's cold enough to have water, there appears to be water and lots of water. The moon just seems to be a bit of a more complex, less understood body at this point. So this is really why we need a series of missions to attack this on multiple fronts to really get at understanding some of these questions. So the way VIPER approaches this problem is with respect to exploration science. We are working in general, not just VIPER, but everybody, in terms of understanding water and other volatiles in the moon in terms of resources. We've got definite information that shows that there is water there. It's indicated. We've, in some instances, measured it, but we need much more information. And the critical observations that are needed are listed there on the left. First, we need to understand its distribution. We need to understand where it's located, both laterally and vertically. We need to understand its physical state. Is it bound chemically? Is it ice in regolith? Is it blocky ice? How is it actually there? And then we importantly need to understand its context and correlation. And this is really important for understanding, well, how would we excavate it if it was there? How would we get at it? But also from a scientific perspective, understanding its context and correlation means we can understand the physical properties and characteristics of the environment that are controlling its distribution, its retention, its loss, et cetera. So these four aspects, these four points are critical to the VIPER mission, and understanding the distribution, the physical state, the context, and the correlation. These are, as a brief summary of the VIPER measurement requirements. The first is, again, determine the water distribution across what we call ice stability regions. The figure on the right shows a predicted ice stability depth. This comes from modeling that Dave Page and Matt Siegler have done with us, where they look at the depth at which temperatures are always cold enough for water ice to be stable. It doesn't mean water's there. It just means the temperatures are at least cold enough for it to be stable over long geologic periods of time. The white areas in this the upper figure are where water ice is stable at the surface. These are the permanently shadowed cold traps. We've on the project to organize this in terms of a mapping process, defined these areas as ice stability regions and divided them into four categories. Surface, so that's PSR cold traps, water is expected to be stable at the surface. Shallow, it's in the top 50 centimeters, it's expected to be stable. Deep, bottom 50 centimeters. And dry, we do not expect temperatures to be always cold enough to hold water down to the depth of more than 1 meter. And so this allows us to actually categorize, plan, and put together a mission around identifying and characterizing these ice stability regions. And an important aspect here is covering enough area to do this. This Viper really is a reconnaissance mapping mission. It's not going to one of these sites and making a measurement. It has specific requirements for overall area density and coverage. And again, this gets back to the resource mapping techniques we use on Earth. We'd be using advanced geospatial interpolation techniques like kriging to actually get at better estimates of the overall water ice content in regolith. So we have to cover a significant area, not just make point measurements. We need to measure down to at least a 0.5% weight water. We do much better than that. Also importantly, for science, we measure key isotopes, which will help us to understand the origin. We have to also cover large scales. There's expected to be quite a bit of heterogeneity, especially in the top meter. So we need to measure scales from decimeters all the way to kilometers. And we have to measure subsurface. We need to profile the water ice or volatile concentration as a function of depth.
Once Viper has located volatile materials on the moon, the pressure will be on to bring samples to Earth for a complete analysis. In November of 2021, Clive Neal of the University of Notre Dame put the case for surface missions to understand the moon.
So evolving CLIPS by reconnaissance sample return is a is the sort of subtitle to this one. We have numerous documents we can go to. We can go to the 2007 SCEM report. We can the current decadal that it's about to come defunct. That talks about sample return, and especially from South Pole Aiken Basin, the New Frontiers class mission. But it also looks at the nature of volatiles, recent lunar activity, and then reconstructions of the thermotectonic magmatic evolution of the moon and the impact history through sample return. If you look at the midterm, it actually talks about, you know, properly budgeting for sample return. We know that samples are the gift that keep on giving. And so keeping them preserved for future generations allows not only the training of the next generation for analyzing planetary materials, but also in making new scientific discoveries as the technology improves and we can do more sophisticated analyses. So again, the Lunar Exploration Roadmap the League put together, all those objectives there, not just in the science category, all have robotic sample return as an early stage. And also development of sample return technology has feed forward implications to other destinations. So we've got rich sources of justification in terms of science documents. And if we look at the data that we have from orbit, we can put together these maps, which show potential locations to actually address some of the science questions that have been put forward. And reconnaissance sample return away from Artemis landings can guide future human exploration. But the other thing that we also have is this sort of exploration and engineering goals of samples as well, which actually require much more sample mass because our simulants, no matter how hard we try, still remain Earth materials, not lunar materials. We can do targeted sample return. Well, we hope we can. We know that it can be done because it's been done recently by Chang'e 5. And if we look at the sort of breaking down a robotic sample return mission, we can see that we've got to land at the desired location. We've got to gather the sample. We've got to launch back to Earth, and we've got to successfully land back on Earth. And putting those things together, we can see that there are evolution in sample return missions. So, for example, if we land at the desired location, is a static lander sufficient where we just do a grab sample of regolith because we are confident that the materials we need to address the science are going to be incorporated in that particular regolith? Is mobility needed? Do we need a fetch rover? How far does it need to go? And precision landing, how precise do we need to be to make a static lander possible? And these are all questions that need to be looked at when we're starting to evolve the technology needed to do robotic sample return. The, you know, gather the sample is bulk regolith sufficient? Do we actually need hand samples? We know from Apollo that the hand samples have been preserved, and we've got wealth of data from those samples. How are we going to transfer from a fetch rover to a sample return capsule? Will we require special storage capabilities? Are we looking at cryogenics? Are we going to be able to return some of the water ice that is in these permanently shadowed craters? And are surface samples sufficient, or do we need a stratigraphy of the regolith? You know, launching back to Earth, we know that the Soviets did this. They did a direct to Earth trajectory from launching from the moon. But then the Chang'e 5 lander did a rendezvous with an orbiter and then came back to Earth. So we've got the science requirements that need to be looked at as an evolving capability in sample return. We've got to land back on Earth. You know, can we actually, is litho breaking permitted? Do we capture it in the atmosphere? Do we parachute it and let it come in as a reasonably soft landing? What's the minimum mass? I suggest 2 kilograms, because we need to be able to preserve this for future generations. We need to be able to go back and test the hypotheses that come out of initial sample return. And again, this all requires cost, it requires development. We need to think about the evolution of our CLIPS program to sort of have a list of questions. Landing with a static lander to gather regolith and then bring it back to Earth is probably the simplest way of doing it, but not all of the landing sites that are in those maps will actually be able to actually get the right samples with a static lander. Right now, we've got an evolution of CLIPS going along from initially disparate payloads, and again, big implications for CONOPS. We've got less than 1 lunar day duration, although we've heard some CLIPS providers can do better than that. Communications back to Earth, there's some mobility being provided. So this represents a great start. And as I said in the panel, we need to evolve this program into something that is credible, that has boundaries that we can point to, saying that now we really need to do a discovery or new frontiers mission, because the capabilities offered by this frequent program will not address the science or exploration goals that we've developed. And evolving CLIPS. So this is the beginning of the roadmap, Amy, if you like. Again, reconnaissance sample return. I use the term reconnaissance because not all questions are going to be answered by one sample. And again, it's also limited compared to the samples will not be as generous as we would get from human exploration. So these are reconnaissance, and they need to be viewed as such. And we need to be evolving these to more targeted samples with more complicated fetch rovers. Now, is this outside the cost cap of CLIPS? Well, then we've got this is actually a discovery or new frontiers mission. Mobility over several kilometers. It's important for resource prospecting. It's mapping lunar swirls, so on and so forth. Mobility is enabling. And then surviving and operating during the lunar night, in fact, multiple lunar nights. If that can happen in Eclipse budget, then maybe it can enable a long-lived geophysical network on the moon. The current capabilities cannot, because the capabilities that are being reported by the commercials cannot survive multiple lunar nights. And then we get to CLIPS to other destinations, which has already been talked about by the Mars community. But what about CLIPS to asteroids? What about the trade space needs to be opened up, and we do need a successful CLIPS landing on the moon to be very, very enabling. And with that, I will stop.
The main push behind Viper is to find strategic volatile resources that could be extracted to support human settlement of the moon. Robert Stael works at the Instrument Division of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. In May of 2020, he posed the question, can Artemis astronauts find strategic volatile resources?
How might we best, with a small package requiring low resources from in terms of size, mass, power, data, and so on, what volatiles there are at the surface or immediately beneath the astronauts and the immediate landing site vicinity where Artemis lands. And there's a combination of three instruments that can provide information about the surface and subsurface. The first is kind of begins with the Mars 2020 cameras, but instead of having a visible sensor, it would have an infrared Bayer filter sensor, which I'll show on. But it turns out that the different volatiles, water in particular, but if present, any carbon and nitrogen bearing compounds, such as were found in the Cabeas ejecta from Elcross, that it's possible to distinguish those as surface ices in the infrared by looking at a variety of different wavelengths together. In the visible, they all just look like white ice, but in the infrared, they can look dramatically different. Then the second instrument in this suite is a neutron spectrometer, and basically this is Craig Hargrove's Luna 8 map spectrometer, but instead of 8 units that are flying at a couple of kilometers a second overhead, tens of kilometers overhead, because things are going much more slowly and you're much closer to the ground, you can get good spatial resolution and about the same depth of penetration, about 1 meter, with a single detector unit. And then the final one is a ground penetrating radar. There have been a number of varieties of those flown, of course. And so this one is based on work that we've been doing at JPL on dramatically miniaturizing RF circuits, basically by going to software radios like we did with the Iris radio that's used on a number of CubeSats. And they can be deployed in a variety of ways on a crew rover or a robotic rover, where it can go to the edge of a crater and then split in half, and then half of it can go down a very steep slope. Or they can even be carried on something so small as the Sojourner rover. So four deployments are considered for these. One is that suite of three instruments on a crew rover, just attached anywhere where there's a view of the multiband IR camera. It doesn't need to be an integrated package, but it can be. Second is this basically the same thing on a robotic rover. And then for astronaut held, if there's not a rover available, or if there is and there's a good reason to do this, a handheld about 1 kilogram video version of the IR camera that can provide a real-time map of what different volatile substances or regolith are in the field of view. Finally, where you have a combination of ground-penetrating radar and neutron spectrometer that an astronaut can place in different places where there's an expectation that there might be a variation in subsurface ice. So can Artemis astronauts find strategic volatile resources, as well as what will that tell us about the science? Well, of course, it all depends on where they land, and we don't know what's going to be there. That's the whole reason for bringing this set of instruments. We believe it's an affordable mass, power, and minimal crew interface. And it turns out for non-water substances, if there are any volatiles bearing carbon or nitrogen on the moon, that's likely to be of considerable strategic value as operations on the moon go on, rather than having those substances have to come from Earth. So we could map any volatile deposits and quantify those that are in illuminated areas visible to the astronauts, in some illuminated, non-illuminated nearby areas, such as accessed by the astronauts in brief forays or by a robotic rover into permanently shadow regions, and just automatically under all traverse paths. And then a ground crew or the astronauts could go to particularly interesting spots, say the shadow of a large boulder or a crater rim, that sort of thing, and map what's under the surface with very short, sub-1 minute integration times. Thank you.
And so back to Viper's project scientist, Anthony Colapret.
This is a quick overview of the Viper surface segment, the rover. It is rather boxy, but that's because it has solar panels basically all around its sides. It's the sun's never above about 5 to 6 degrees above the horizon to the poles, so it's always coming in right above the horizon. But most importantly, it is a solar-powered rover. It's not nuclear. And it uses direct-to-Earth communications, so it's not relying on a relay satellite at all. Those are key in terms of determining where and when it can go on the lunar surface. Yeah, this is the instrument overview, I think. It has four primary instruments on it. The ones across the top are on continuously while roving and drilling. We never turn them off in a nominal scenario. And that's really important, again, to get this total coverage that we need. We need to absolutely have total coverage. So the rover's been designed to be to accommodate this requirement. On the left is a neutron spectrometer. It's out in front of the rover, and it's measuring hydrogen down to a meter's depth continuously as we're going. The one in the middle is a mass spectrometer, MSOLO. It measures, again, while driving, gases coming up from the surface and also while drilling, characterizing cuttings. The instrument on the far right, NIRVIS, is a combination of a near-infrared spectrometer, a thermal radiometer, and a multicolor imaging system. That's characterizing the surface composition, frosts and ices, et cetera. And then finally, lower left is the Trident drill. It's a 1 meter percussive auger drill that will sample in 10 centimeter bites down to the surface so we can profile water content with depth. The CLIPS office is delivering the rover to the surface with a CLIPS lander. That first part, the lunar transfer, lunar orbit and landing, that's not our mission. That is the Astrobotic mission who provides the lander. This is, again, part of the really exciting new paradigm of CLIPS. Once we land, then it becomes the Viper mission. We're looking at about 100, maybe more, days on the lunar surface, and it's broken up into these various legs. Because we're direct-to-Earth communication, we have to get into what we call a hibernation state, or really it's a safe haven state, as we call it, where the Earth sets below horizon and we can no longer communicate and rove. We're not autonomous, we're semi-autonomous. So anytime we're out of comm, the rover parks. What that means is every about 14 days or so, we find an area that's nice and sunny. I'll talk about this more in a bit, and park and wait for the Earth to come back up, and then we continue the mission. I mentioned, or it's been mentioned a few times, the Griffin lander. This is Astrobotic Technology is delivering delivering the Viper rover on this lander. So we have two primary modes of operation that I've touched on already a little bit. One we call prospecting, and that really means driving and measuring continuously while we're driving. As I mentioned, we have the neutron spectrometer, the near-infrared spectrometer system, and this mass spectrometer, MSOLO, on continuously while driving. As we go along, we can track neutron count rate, which is directly a function of the amount of hydrogen and how deeply the hydrogen's buried. We can measure surface temperature, gases coming off, surface frost. We'll be able to do these all simultaneously and be able to correlate all these things together, which again is really important to help us better understand the processes controlling the distribution of the volatiles. And then we have drilling. So prospecting and drilling. The drilling we call subsurface assays. And what happens there is we park and we begin to drill. While drilling, what we do is we come down in 10 centimeter bites, we bring up a sample of 10 centimeters in length, brush it onto the surface, and that forms a cuttings pile. The MSOLO mass spectrometer and the NIRVIS near-infrared spectrometer are looking at that continuously. We've demonstrated this in testing many times, I think about four or five times at Glenn over the years. And it's a really easy, relatively easy, simple technique to characterize quite well how much water is actually in the subsurface. So each 10 centimeter bite, we image it as well to understand what's coming up and the forming of the pile, et cetera. But why this is important, not just to get that vertical profile for itself, but the neutron spectrometer can use actually those vertical profiles to better constrain the modeling as to where what the burial depth is. The neutron spectrometer measures both epithermal and thermal neutrons. If they have a way to better understand the depth of the desiccated layer, they can actually get a much more accurate prediction of the total hydrogen content and burial depth along the entire traverse. So it's just like we do in terrestrial prospecting or exploration. You have a lot of denser data sets, and then you have diffuse data sets drilling to help you understand that dense data set. Where are we going? Well, we've been studying a lot of places, both North and South Pole. We are definitely going to the South Pole, and we've looked at three primary locations. These are governed by, one, where we see a significant amount of hydrogen. Two, there's a variety of thermal environments. We need to be able to visit all the ice stability regions I mentioned earlier. We can't just visit one or two. We want a variety of them. Three, we need the periods of shadow when the Earth goes down to be relatively short. We're solar powered and battery powered. So when the sun goes down, we rely on our batteries to stay warm. At each of these sites, we have to do a lot of dynamic traverse planning. Because we're solar powered and direct to Earth, we have to constantly be in sunlight and in calm, unless we go to shadow ops, which we do when we go into a PSR. And so we have to look at dynamic maps, static maps like slopes, and reconcile them all in our traverse planning and landing site analysis. So we've got this fascinating, complicated story about lunar water, and there's going to be a number of assets, not just Viper, brought to bear on these new questions. And this is really an incredible, exciting time for all of us leading into Artemis and beyond. Viper will conduct exploration science, addressing both fundamental science question as well as exploration science critical to ISRU architectures. And it, as such, it really cornerstone for both for a great number of communities in terms of taking the first steps to understanding the distribution and origin of lunar water. Thank you.
And that was Anthony Colapret, the project scientist for Viper, bringing to a close this episode of Lunar Science.